My name is Maggie Mastin, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. Today, I am joined by Norma Wong, Zen master, author, political strategist, and Native Hawaiian. Norma is visiting Dickinson College to deliver a Clark Forum program tonight titled The World as We Would Have It Be, Collective Thriving in the Time Place of Collapse. This will be a conversation between Norma and David McMahon, a professor of religious studies at Franklin and Marshall College. Today, she is joining me for an interview. Welcome, Norma Wong.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I was thinking we could start off talking about how you define your identity, because in your book, When No Thing Works, you discuss how important understanding identity is to having productive, deeper conversations. So would you share with us a little bit about your own identity and what shapes it most and how it shows up in your work?
Thank you for the question. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that I would answer it differently just a short time ago, but a thing that really identifies me now is I just turned 70. So I just entered the first part of my eighth decade as a human being. And I think that that is now very significantly placing me in what I think of as the work I still have to do and the work that I have already done. So it's like a time left and time that has passed, and time that has been put in. And so I would say time is a big identifier for me these days. I'm also a woman, and I am a Native Hawaiian, someone who's indigenous to that place called Hawaii. I'm Hakka, who are like nomadic people of China who came to Hawaii many, many years ago. I am a person who is single and who lives with her sister and two cats. So those are parts of the identities I have at the moment.
I'm glad that you brought up how age has shaped your perspective of it. And I know that in a lot of your work, you talk about kind of the divide between generations and how different experiences and priorities can kind of bring a gap between people of different ages. Could you share some ways in which we can be more accommodating or more thoughtful in order to bridge that gap?
So I think that one way is to think of it as there is a gap only if we stay in our own generational lanes. But since the gap exists, if we are in multi-generational spaces, then we close the potential of gaps between us and make it possible for us to collectively see things that we wouldn't see if we just stay in our generational lane, you know. Mm-hmm. So a thing that I am, I did not take it for granted, but that I would be welcome as a guest by folks who are in 18 to 22 years old as I entered my eighth decade, I think is pretty spectacular.
I would have to agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing that you are now doing active work to follow up your words and connecting with different generations and talking with people who are different than yourself. You spent 30 plus years in politics and electoral politics. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced in this work?
Well, I would say the most challenging aspects of that would be that many issues are not simple. They have ways in which they are involve many communities and many points of view, and the difficulty becomes people being able to have responsibility for all of it, not just be advocates for their part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the most difficult part.
Especially in Hawaii, you have a lot of different viewpoints that you're trying to bring together into one.
Yes, and I think that's also one of our advantages because Hawaii is geographically small, that and we are separated long distances from the continent, that, you know, we've come to understand that if we don't solve our own problems, they're not going to be solved by anybody else.
Is that how you would define success in your political career then? Is like really, as you represented Hawaii and really taking responsibility for that, those islands and those people?
Well, I would say that success is about whether we see whatever we do as not only solving a problem that has happened in the past or that is happening now, but if we, when we do that, if we make the possibilities for what's going to happen next.
So more future looking.
More future looking,
yes.
Yeah.
In your involvement with mediating the controversy over the telescope project in Hawaii, where Hawaiians were protesting its installment, could you talk about what that experience was like for you? And were there any approaches that you found really worked or didn't work in mediating those disputes?
So I was involved in that along with many other people.
Mm-hmm.
First, I would say that it was very emotional, right? It's hard to see people feel like they have to go to extreme measures, right? In order not only to be heard, but to make something happen. But it's also emotional in terms of the pride that you might feel of people who will be ready to arise together, not as individuals, but together, and to have our culture unapologetically in practice, right? Unapologetic mm-hmm. practice. So Native Hawaiians effectively occupied a certain altitude of the mauna, of the mountain,
mm-hmm.
For over 200 days. But in that time, that they fed each other, there was a little field hospital, elders got their blood pressure taken, children that came would engage in a field classrooms. If you went to the mana, there'd be people there who would be able to help you learn different things. That part of the cultural protocol is that if you're angry, do not come up to the mountain.
Interesting.
Okay.
So it created a real sense of community, but also less anger at fighting against whatever they didn't want to happen, and more collective progress, a little bit of serenity in the process.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. And so that whatever side you were on, because there were Hawaiians who were for the telescope,
mm-hmm.
and there were Hawaiians who were opposed, and there were people who are not Hawaiian who are for and against, right? But whatever side, people began to see what was happening as something different that was occurring, that really called for a different way, not just for people to be coming to a compromise that would fall apart easily, right? And so the work that has happened since, which is still ongoing, is for all of the different people, including the astronomers, including the university, including the state of Hawaii, including the community, including Hawaiians, to put Mauna Kea, the mountain itself, at the center of our concern.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And if it is so special, both for the scientists as well as Hawaiians, then scientists and Hawaiians have almost a sacred responsibility to make sure that the specialness of that place doesn't get ruined, right? The specialness of the place, right?
So that's kind of the common link that you found between the two sides, was just both their care about that place specifically, even though they were caring about it for different reasons.
That's right. Could we see us bound by our responsibility for mutual stewardship, right? Which mm-hmm. which is the concept that we were advancing here, right? Mutual mm-hmm. mutual stewardship. So we may have different reasons and purposes, but what can we work together towards?
In your, it makes me think about something you talked about in your book, which was triangulation and the idea of bringing together multiple perspectives and to kind of search for the truth is how I took it. I think you made a little quip about the truth is the intersection of all perspectives, if only we could know that. Can you share a little bit about this in practice and how it can impact a person?
So first of all, it requires you to listen as much as it might for you to share, right? And so you have to have people get to the place where they're in good enough relationship with each other that you might be able to deeply listen. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't exist, then the question is, can I or can you deeply listen to whatever it is that's being expressed without putting your judgment on it, okay? And listen for the places of truth that, you know, so whenever we express things, especially when we express things when we're really emotional about it, there'll be all kinds of drama and extra stuff that we add and many justifications, right, to whatever it's going to say. And underneath all of that, there'll be like these jewels of truth. Can we discover that, right? And then can we discover the jewels of truth that exist between people who we would otherwise consider to be opponents, right? Can we discover what the truth is?
So there's also that idea of creating a space in which people are comfortable enough to share their experiences and their viewpoints. And if they're not, if they feel as though they constantly have to defend themselves or justify what they're saying, you're not going to get to those jewels of truth, as you put it.
That's right. And then there's like the conditions have to be there. But there are also ways that you could do it even if the conditions are not there, if you've created the conditions in you.
Yeah.
Don't feel like the moment you sit down that you have to explain yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. You've made an interesting decision to stay off of social media.
Yes.
In this day and age, is a really powerful one. And I wanted to hear what has been the most beneficial to you, but also if there's anything that's really been frustrating about that choice that you've made.
Well, so Maggie, the listeners won't know this, but you've seen that I have a flip phone.
Yeah. I have.
Yeah, and if you read the book, I talk about my flip phone. So I would say the most frustrating thing is a flip phone will not read a QR code.
Yeah.
It'll take a picture of it, but then you just have a picture of a QR code.
What everyone doesn't think about.
Right. So I sometimes need someone to accompany me. I need to ask for assistance for something, you know, like paying for parking, right? Mm-hmm. Or recently, I needed to, since I was traveling for a while, I needed to wash my clothes. But the laundry didn't have a coin thing. You have to download an app and then use the QR code to pay, none of which I can do on a flip phone.
Yeah.
So I had to get out my ordinary traditional cash and just give it to someone and say, okay, can you do that for me? Here's the cash. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's that. But otherwise, I haven't found it frustrating at all, because if people know I don't have a smartphone, they know I'm not on social media. So if they feel that there's something going on that I should know about, they just tell me.
It creates a little bit of dependency on other people's for in ways where the modern world is not as accommodating to people without smartphones, but at the same time, it builds more connection between you and people in person.
A lot more connection, a lot more mm-hmm. connection. And it's a safeguard for me to not be bombarded by mm-hmm. all kinds of things all the time, or to be lured by the bait of something in social media. So,
could you talk about that a little bit more and how maybe you see it impacting other people?
Yeah, so I see people like down in their devices and not looking up out in the world. And I would say people look lonelier and lonelier, even though they're so hyper-connected to all of these things, mm-hmm. right? And that there's also a little bit of, I guess what I would call social awkwardness. Right, people, with it's like they know how to be in relationship to all kinds of ideas and notions and images and things of that sort. But between each other, there's a little bit of awkwardness
mm-hmm.
because, frankly speaking, whether you're an extrovert or an introvert, and I'm an introvert, right? It's like, to be in relationship to different people, you actually need practice. So I think people don't get enough practice with that. But then it's also like, it's just plain dangerous when you're looking at your device and crossing the street, for example.
And is that something you notice in the, obviously that has a pretty big impact across generations. As looking at the younger generation, is that a fear that you have of how we might continue into the future?
Well, when babies know how to swipe the phone to change what it's on, yes, I do get concerned about that,
mm-hmm.
right? What kind of patterning may be occurring by children before it is that you have other kinds of thinking processes? The concern I have is whether we will outsource our critical thinking rather than entering into our own critical thinking between each other, right? Whether or not we'll put as much investment and time into human intelligence as we are in artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
That said, generationally, I saw an article recently that said that boomers are as habitually attached to their devices
mm-hmm.
as younger generations. So I think it's just widespread in society now.
In terms of forms of communication, I know that writing a book was a little bit of a switch of how you used to choose to communicate. Why did you choose to make that switch?
I did it very reluctantly, and only after a few people, and in particular, there's a man named Todd James, and he really was very persistent over about 18 months. And finally, he asked the question whether the wisdom that's been passed generation to generation can be applied fast enough in a world that seems to be collapsing if you are only passing it along in the traditional way.
Yeah. So it's a matter of keeping up with kind of how everything is quickening these days.
That's correct. Everything is quickening. And how do you keep up in terms of usage, not in terms of relevance? So if it's relevant that's fine. If it's not relevant, that's fine. But if there is knowledge that can be used, then it needs to be distributed. Mm. So.
And in your book, the writing style that you use is really distinctive, I think, and intriguing. It's more reflective and poetic, I think, than strictly like academic. Is there a certain approach that you would recommend to readers who are interested, like a headspace maybe to be in when reading your book?
Oh, a headspace. Oh, that's interesting. So I do know some folks, what they say to me is that if they listen to my audiobook and read the book at the same time, mm-hmm. so at the same moment, that they get, you know, almost a multi-dimensional experience of the word, and that has been useful to them. The other two things I would say is, although it's a small book, that it should be taken in small doses. And also think of it as a concentrate that you add your own water to.
Mm-hmm. So the smaller chunks you take it in, you apply it to your own experiences, your life, the things you're hearing, and you'll kind of discover your own things based on what you read rather than just taking it exactly word for word.
Yes, something like that.
You've talked about people having their head down in their phones or the importance of listening. And then with your book, the multidimensional sensory experience, are senses a big part of the work you do or how you cultivate your own progress, I guess, your own experience in the world?
So what would you like to, what are you curious about?
I'm curious about, I guess, maybe how you would apply them to your own practice in Zen Buddhism. How do they play a role in what you're trying to achieve when maybe you go to meditate or you're trying to practice?
Well, in the Zazen, which is the deep meditative practice, that it's useful to bring in a question or a purpose into your meditation. Not so that you would be filling it in your mind or going over it in your mind, but that you'd have a sense of sitting for something that's bigger than who it is that you are, right? It's something larger. And then you are creating the condition with your own body and your own breath, right? And the time, place that you are sitting in for the response to that question to emerge. Not to be immediately answered, but for you to start to move in the right direction around it. So I'd say it's a combination of like a compass as well as a gravitational pull.
You've practiced Rinzai Zen Buddhism at, I hope I'm saying it right, Dai Hontan Chosenji.
You did. Right? You said it correctly.
Great. And you were there for, you've practiced there for over 40 years. What stands out to you as special, or specifically, what drew you into that kind of practice?
What drew me into the practice is that it doesn't require me to believe in anything, but just to keep on practicing in ways that I could become a better human. And that's it. And then the ways of practice are very practical, you know, so sitting and moving, you know, I do cooking, right? I do Zen cooking. And so all of the ways are very practical that I can practice them anywhere. But the temple would be a place where everyone who is there is also practicing at the same time. And so when that happens, it gets magnified, just like a university, right? Mm-hmm. Technically speaking, you could study all the things online these days, separate and apart, But your experience would be entirely different if you did that and you weren't studying it together in that same way.
I found it super interesting when I was looking into the kind of things that that temple does and the classes that they have and how it's a mix of like the arts and meditation and martial arts. Do you find that by like cultivating a certain mindset in these activities, it helps you to translate it into your life outside of the temple or like your day-to-day activities?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the reason for the triangulation, right? Zazen, martial arts, and fine arts, is that each of those alone won't necessarily help you to figure out the many dimensionalities that you are. But the fine arts helps you to see perspective and focus and relationality and how too much of a thing will actually mean that there's nothing that is beautiful, right? And so, and also in the making of it, how can you do it without hesitation, right? How doing it one way, if it's beautiful, it's only because of luck, but it will take many, 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 many practices. So the practice, right, is fundamental between the three, right? You never master any of them. You essentially just keep practicing, and in the practice, the discipline of that practice that helps you to see things and figure things out. And that's directly applicable to everyday life. Now, can't expect that the first time out you're going to be able to do anything.
It cultivates a sense of discipline and dedication to the things that you work on.
Yes.
I know that some of the founders of that temple were skilled in calligraphy and swordsmanship.
That's correct.
Is there a specific art or practice that you found yourself really dedicated to?
Well, I am dedicated to the calligraphy, and I'm also dedicated to the kado, which is the flower arranging. And I also practice in the Zen cooking. So those would be the like the art forms that I have, along with I do the physical practice called Nei Gong, which is done as which is taught in the Tai Chi class. And the Nei Gong is translated to inner work. So it uses breath and movement to move everything in you that is liquid.
Interesting. Specifically liquid.
Specifically anything that's liquid.
Have you found that this practice has connected you more to nature and the physical landscape of Hawaii?
Not only to the physical landscape of Hawaii, but the physical landscape of any place I visit.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. As you look ahead into the future, is there anything that, aside from maybe the more fearful things we might have in terms of technology and such, but is there anything that really brings you hope about the direction that we might be moving in?
Yes. What brings me hope is that people are beginning to see that you have a lot of agency, separate and apart from systems and governments and all those kinds of things, to be in relationship with each other and to help each other and to figure things out together. And that actually brings me a lot of hope. Because if we can do that, then we'll become less dependent on things that, even when they're trying to be beneficial, are really struggling, right? Really struggling. Mm-hmm. So, for example, okay, there are people who would not want to fund food assistance. And then there are people who would want to fund it, but there's never enough.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way in which if we are able to share food with each other in either system, one in which it's trying hard but it's struggling, or they don't want to fund it as much, that we become less dependent on that. And at the same time, we're making sure that people have enough to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So is that what brings me hope is our reclaiming of possibility, not dependent on a thing called a government, or a thing called a program, or a thing called a system. That brings me hope.
Very cool. All right, this concludes our interview. On behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you for having this conversation with me.
Thank you so much. Thank you for asking.